Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. So glad you're joining me today. Journalist Tommy Tomlinson kept his exact weight a secret. He didn't tell his wife or his mother, but in the opening pages of his new memoir, Tommy tells us, the reader, that at his heaviest, he weighed 460 pounds. He goes on to tell us that he wore a size XXXXXXL. He also tells us that those are the hardest words he's ever had to write. Frightened into action by the death of his beloved sister Brenda, Tommy decided to figure out what his friend drunkenly asked him one day, which he quotes in the book, and the question was this: why are you so fat anyway? He tackles this and chronicles his weight loss in his candid new memoir, The Elephant in the Room, One Fat Man's Quest to Get Smaller in a Growing America. It is equal parts a reflection on a lifetime of weight struggle and an expose on what it means to live as an obese man in America, and an investigation into what makes Americans continue to grow larger. Tommy has been successfully losing weight for more than 2 years now, and he joins us. Hi, Tommy. Thanks for being on All of It.
Hey, Allison, how you doing?
I'm doing great. You write in the book that you really can't remember a time when you weren't overweight. When you think back to when you were a kid, what led to you overeating as a kid?
Well, the food was so good. I mean, you know, I grew up in the Deep South down on the Georgia coast, and food was, for our family, wealth. We didn't grow up with much money. My mom and dad worked in basically factory jobs when I was growing up. My mom was later a waitress. And food was sort of the best outer expression of wealth for us, because my mom and dad, you know, we didn't have fancy cars or clothes or anything like that, but we could make a great meal. And so from the beginning of my life, food was all tied up in what was wealth in our family and what was love and affection and all those sorts of things. And we also moved from sort of a blue-collar life to a white-collar life, where my mom and dad worked really hard with their backs and their hands. I didn't, but I ate the same meals that they did. They could burn off those meals at work, and I didn't, and that's how I got big.
At what point in your life did you go from just being kind of a big guy, a husky guy, a husky kid, to being a person who had a real weight problem?
For me, it was probably in my 20s. You know, I was always a big guy, always the biggest guy in the class. But when I went off to college at the University of Georgia, it was sort of unsupervised. As you know, they talk about many college students have that freshman 15. For me, it was more like a freshman 50. You know, I was able to, you know, sort of eat what I wanted. All the dining halls were, you know, all you could eat. And I could also start drinking basically unsupervised. And so my first couple of years in college, I put away a lot of beer and screwdrivers and those kinds of things, and ballooned up pretty fast. And I think those years where I just was out on my own, had a little spending money, and didn't have anybody to tell me or basically to watch out for me, those were the years that I got really, really big.
Was there a moment during that time when you think, you know what, now that you're an adult, looking back, you think, wow, this was the moment, or this was the period of time when I could have made decisions that really would have changed my life?
One decision I think about a lot was when I was a senior in high school. I was a junior in high school, and it was the last day of school, and I was walking through the hallways, and the football coach said, oh, congratulations on graduating. And I said, well, actually, I hadn't graduated yet. I got one more year to go. And he said, oh, man, I wish I had known that. We could have made you into a football player. They had already had spring practice and that sort of thing by that point. And I kept going, and part of me thought about turning around and coming back and saying, you know, let me try out. You know, I never played organized football or anything. But that would have been a point in my life when I would have exercised every day, probably for the first time ever. I would have lifted weights, I would have run, I would have done all those things that football players do. You know, there may have been long-term consequences, because a lot of football players now obviously have concussions and joint problems and that sort of thing. But that was a moment for me when I could have committed to getting in shape seriously for the first time in my life, and I just kept walking.
My guest is Tommy Tomlinson. The name of his memoir is The Elephant in the Room. Can you give folks a sense of the kind of things that happened to you in your childhood that, because of your weight, that people don't really think about? I mean, I think we all have thought about the poor kid who's the last one picked for soccer or dodgeball because they know the kid can't run that fast.
Right.
But what are some of the things that people don't really think about that kids are going through?
Well, I think for me, it was a matter of literally fitting in sometimes. Like the desks they had built for kids were not, you know, they were built, probably the ones we had in our school were built in the 50s or 60s, and Americans had gotten bigger. And so a lot of times I would sit down at my desk and I literally could not kind of wedge myself in the old school desk and would have to sort of sit in there sideways or be in a really uncomfortable position. And all those sorts of things. You know, there were PE classes where, I still remember in eighth grade, I had a PE class where we were supposed to climb a rope to the ceiling of the gym. You know, these days that probably would be legislated out of existence, but everybody was supposed to do that back then. And I found myself ducking into the restroom. I think about it now, and I think the coaches probably knew I was doing that. It wasn't like I was being clever and avoiding this exercise, but there was no way I could have climbed to the top of the gym on a rope, you know? And so there were all these moments that were sort of kind of signature moments for kids that I either didn't experience or they were really hard experiences. The other one I think of all the time, which guys have to deal with, is when you split up into teams, you have shirts and skins. And I was terrified to take off my shirt because I knew how I looked underneath. You know, I looked terrible. I had all these rolls of fat even when I was a little kid. And of course, inevitably, I would end up on the skins team and I would have to strip off my shirt in front of everybody and just take that embarrassment.
Did you carry that all through your life? That sense of embarrassment, that sense of shame hiding in the bathroom?
Sure. I to some extent, I've always, you know, felt like I was in the way. You know, even when I'm not. If I'm in a crowded room or on a subway train or, you know, just any place where there's a lot of people around, I always feel like everybody's trying to make their way around me. And so I end up kind of standing in the corner or off to the side and not experiencing things in the same way other people do. Another one for me is elevators. So if I'm standing waiting for an elevator, and the door opens, and it's, let's say it's half full. And I can see the looks on the people in the elevator, like, is that guy going to get in here with us? And then what's that going to mean? And they're looking at the load limit on the elevator, and they have this sort of wary look in their eyes. And if I see that at all, I just don't get on the elevator. I just wait for the next one. And so, yeah, those things that happened to me as a kid, I certainly have carried through into my adulthood. I'm always sort of wary of, I'm always noticing where I am at every moment, how that relates to other people, and where I can fit in and be comfortable.
You go out of your way not to put any of the blame on your parents in this book. You talk about your family a lot, and it sounds like you talk about what a loving family you had and how you grew up, and you just say this isn't really their fault. But you also talk about how they did bring it up to you. One, why did you go out of your way to make sure that your parents were absolved of anything to do with this? And two, why didn't their attempts at intervention work?
Well, to the first question, I think they just didn't understand back then because they lived such a different life than the one I lived. You know, I talked about that shift from blue-collar work to white-collar work, which is certainly not unique to my life. Many generations of people have dealt with that. And they just did not connect, you know, the food I was eating to the weight I was gaining. And it seems obvious now, but they just didn't think about it because they had eaten that food their whole lives, excuse me, and none of them had ever gotten fat. But when my generation came, we didn't do the yard work or the blue-collar jobs that sort of burned off all those calories. It just took them, I think, a while for them to understand how they were contributing to it. And so I give them the benefit of the doubt there. But you're right, they did try to intervene at several points, whether they fully understood or not. You know, my dad was always sort of more subtle and gentle about it. My mom was more face front and direct about it. And I think I was just the type of person who, you know, like many teenagers, I didn't want to listen to what my parents were saying. I knew they were right, but I didn't want to listen. And more than that, I enjoyed the lifestyle I was leading. You know, we've talked about already all the sort of guilt and shame I was feeling. But on the other side of it, I was eating all this great food and I was enjoying it. And it was a form of fellowship with my friends. That's what we did together. We go out and, you know, have a big meal together. And that obviously continued and continues well into my adulthood. And so there, the pleasure of food for me, in the moment especially, always outweighed the pain. And that happened for a long, long time. You know, you can convince yourself in the moment, and this is something I think is very familiar to like drug addicts and alcoholics, you can convince yourself that this little hit you're getting is so pleasurable that it's worth the consequences. And you don't think about the long term in those moments. And I spent many years of my life not really thinking about the long term.
My guest is Tommy Tomlinson. The name of his book is The Elephant in the Room. As a writer, you made a really interesting choice when you decided to do this book. One, you're super honest in it. Every chapter ends with your weight and how much you've gained or lost, because you're doing this really slowly and probably the safest way by doing it slowly. But you made this choice of going to your friends, your family, your wife, your loved ones, and interviewing them, because you're a journalist, about you and your your weight. That was really interesting. Why did you do that?
One big role model for me, as I started thinking about this book and reading other books that were similar in one way or another, was a book by a guy named David Carr, who was the longtime media critic of the New York Times.
Oh, the best.
Died a few years ago. Yeah, the best. So he wrote a memoir called The Night of the Gun. And he talked about his early years in Minnesota when he was, you know, making his way as a journalist, but he was also a drug addict. And there were moments in his life that he literally didn't remember what he did. You know, people would tell him about something terrible he had done to his family or his friends or something. And he had blacked out or was high and didn't remember what had happened. So he went back and interviewed the people he was hanging around with during that time and asked them what their memories were of him. Well, for me, I didn't have moments where I had blacked out, obviously, but I did have memories that were probably fuzzier than other people remembered them. And so I asked, as you said, a bunch of my friends, and then I did long conversations with my mom and my wife about what things had happened back then, how people talked about me when I wasn't around, you know, the concerns that they had for me, all those things. And I learned a lot about, you know, what they thought and how deep their concern was for me. And then for my mom and my wife, I just learned about the pain I'd put them through, because they could see me heading toward a very short life and an unhappy one, and they wanted me to be around.
You use the word addiction a lot in the book, and I'm going to read this passage when you describe addiction, how it feels and how it relates to food. You write, "This is a cruel trick of most addictions. They're so good at short-term comfort. I'm hungry. I'm lonely. I need to feel part of the world. Other people soothe those pains with the bottle or the needle. I soothe them with burgers and fries. It pushes the hurt down the road a little bit, like paying the minimum on your credit card bill every month. The debt never gets settled. Those little moments of comfort are also moments of avoiding the discomfort behind it. It is that small instant when the salt and grease get into my veins. It's a release. But then when I look up and out and back, my life is measured not in days or years or heartbeats, but in an unbroken string of takeout bags." Do you consider that you had an addiction?
I do. I mean, I don't, you know, there's some debate in the medical community, you know, whether that's food is considered an actual addiction. My argument on the pro side is that, you know, 40% of Americans can qualify as obese in one way or another these days. Something is clearly happening. And for me, you know, I've never done hard drugs. I never did heroin or cocaine or anything like that. But the feelings that I get when I succumb to, you know, a double cheeseburger or a plate of fried chicken or whatever it might be, a track almost exactly with the feelings that I've heard described from drug addicts or alcoholics. There's that constant craving that never seems to go away. There's that desire for that release when you take the thing or whatever it is. That incredible feeling of euphoria when it happens, and then instantly it going away and you wanting more. I mean, that's almost the textbook definition of an addiction, and that's what I felt like whenever I ate really rich food that was bad for me.
And like most folks with addictions, you were smart enough to know that you needed to get to the root of why you were engaging in this addictive behavior. Like, you know how to lose weight. You keep saying that in the book, and I think most people who've ever had a weight problem, like, you know how to do it. It's like, but the idea is like, why do I have this weight, and how can I keep it off long term? What did you discover about the why?
Yeah, you're right. I think for people who have, let's say, 10 pounds to lose, you could probably figure out a diet and get rid of that and move on with your life. But if you have 200 pounds to lose, the how is never going to be enough. It has to be the why. And so for me, most of this book is about me trying to figure out the why. And I'm not going to say that I've totally got it figured out. You know, it's a process. But I do think that one thing for me is that I have this sort of unsatisfied child inside me, because as a kid, I never got to do a lot of the things that other kids do as a sort of a rites of passage. I never learned to ride a bike because my legs were too big to work the pedals. I never really learned to swim. I didn't climb trees. I never turned a cartwheel, you know, rode a skateboard, all those things that are rites of passage for so many kids. And I think as I got older, that angry kid was still inside me, unsatisfied at all the things I'd missed out on. And the only way I knew how to soothe that kid's anger was with more food. And as during the course of the book, and as I've thought about it over the last few years, I've sort of tried to figure out other ways to calm that angry child down. And so I do things like I listen to music a lot, and I go for long walks, and I spend more time with my wife, sort of time together, quality time together, not just like stopping and starting in the, you know, the middle of the day sort of thing. I spend more time with friends, things that makes that kid happy in a way where I don't have to keep feeding it all the time. And I know those sound like simple, kind of pathetic things, like, why didn't you figure that out sooner? Well, I was busy. I was doing other things. And those doses of food kept that angry kid quiet for a while. So again, it's more of a long-term thing versus a short-term thing. And I think I finally started to figure out some things that make a long-term difference.
My guest is Tommy Tomlinson. The name of his book is The Elephant in the Room, One Fat Man's Quest to Get Smaller in a Growing America. You use the word fat in the title of your book. How do you feel about that word?
I feel the same way lots of other people feel about different words in society. It's okay if my tribe uses it. If you're not...
Don't call my ugly sister ugly.
Right, exactly. I can say whatever I want about my mama. Don't you talk about my mama. But I wanted to put it out there because I think that's how I have seen myself. I'm not overweight or obese or whatever. I'm a fat guy. And so I wanted to speak on those terms from the inside and to let you know how it felt. And I thought that was one way to sort of, you know, jump ahead in the conversation. I'm going to call myself fat in this book, and I want you to understand why.
There's growing movement in the United States. I'm sure you know about it. There's a lot of body positivity, a lot of fat acceptance. But you write in the book, quote, "I don't want the world to expand to make room for me. It's not good for me, and it's not good for the world. I need to make myself fit." Why do you believe that?
Well, first of all, I want to say that there's sort of two aspects to this. The body positivity movement, I think, is a great thing. So if you are what society considers to be overweight, but you are healthy and happy and you like the skin you're in, then screw everybody else. You know, you live the life you want to live. For me, it was an issue of being profoundly unhealthy and unhappy with the skin I was in and needing to change. So I don't want the world to just keep giving me excuses to get bigger. You know, I want the world to help me, you know, figure out ways to get to a place where I'm more comfortable in my body. And so it's different for everyone. And if you are happy in your skin, then I am all for that. But for me, that was not a solution that would make my life better.
And we're not talking, you're not talking just about comfort in terms of emotional comfort. You're talking about physically being in pain and physically having issues with your legs and your veins. Would you share a couple of the things that I think a lot of people, they may not necessarily understand you had to go through when you were at that weight?
Well, I think the main thing that is still an issue for me, not as much as it was I have this problem in my legs where my calves look really rusty and shiny and weird, where I don't really wear shorts too much out in public anymore. And that's caused because my veins can literally not pump the blood back up into my system. They're not strong enough to do that because I weigh so much, and the pressure I'm putting on them keeps them from bringing the blood up the way they should. So little capillaries burst in my calves, and so it gives them this sort of rusty iron color. You know, it's more of a cosmetic problem right now. It certainly can lead to other things down the road. I've been really genetically lucky in that I've never had heart disease or diabetes or high blood pressure or those sorts of things, which are very, very common in people my size. But I do have things every day, you know, just my bones ache. And, you know, whenever, not just walking or running, but when I just stand for so long, my feet and legs and knees just hurt so much from just standing still that I'm just putting so much pressure on my body that it sort of collapses under its own gravity.
One thing comes through loud and clear in this book is that you love your wife, Alex.
It's Alex, by
Alex.
The way.
Alex.
It's a long way.
Oh, yeah. Her name's Alexandria, right?
Yeah, but Alex, that's a family shortening.
Oh, that's cool. You love Alex a lot, but you understand that your weight has had an impact on your marriage. What do you think has been the most significant impact it's had?
It has limited her life. So when we got together, she was a big runner. She hiked all the time. She was outdoorsy and active. And she is still most of those things, but not nearly to the extent that she was when we first started dating. Because I can't do those things or can't do them to the extent that she could, she decided to spend her time with me doing less strenuous activities. And so I feel like I have really limited what she's been able to do in her life. And it breaks my heart to think that. I think there are some things that I've brought to her life that make it better, and I think and believe she would agree with that. But the life she had before me, in some ways, was better than the life she had after me. And you never want that in any kind of relationship. And I just don't know how to make that right.
My guest is Tommy Tomlinson. The name of his memoir is The Elephant in the Room. So the other part, another part, I should say, of the book is your weight loss journey. Tell folks what you decided to do. You decided, and you didn't do any of the fad stuff.
Well, most of the fad stuff, which I've tried most of all of them over the years, are really good at short-term weight loss, and they're terrible at long-term weight loss. So they're good for 30 days, but if you have to do it for 300 days or 3,000 days, they all fail. So I went with a very simple plan. I have this Fitbit on my wrist. It measures how many calories I burn every day. It also has an app where I can track what I eat, and I can measure how many calories I bring in every day. As long as I burn more than I eat, I consider that a win. And so what I've done over the last few years is very slowly and methodically lost, you know, a couple pounds every month. Not every single month. It is a roller coaster, as you'll see in the book. But over time, I am losing this weight slowly and steadily, and I believe sustainably in a way that will keep it off. You know, your body fights you when you try to lose weight because it thinks you're starving. And so it changes its metabolism to try to push you back to where you were. And basically what I'm trying to do right now is fool my body into thinking I'm not trying to lose weight when I actually am, and just doing it in a slow way that will take years for me to get to where I need to go. But at every step along the way, I'm healthier and happier and prouder to be around. And so I feel like it has made great benefits for me already.
So much changes when you lose a large amount of weight. Your relationships change, how you feel about yourself changes. And you wrote in the book this interesting passage. You wrote, "Being fat made me a kid who turned inward. Being fat made me stand out to people inclined to be cruel. Being fat made me think I'd never find love. Being fat made me doubt every good thing about myself. Being fat made me." The past tense is wrong here. I know. I'm still fat, so it still makes me what I am. But part of what I'm trying to do is drag the past back into the past. From here on out, I have to unmake me. What's it like trying to still be Tommy, but be a new Tommy?
Well, it is something that I've worried about a little bit. Like, you know, is my personality going to change a lot as my weight changes? Am I going to be less empathetic or more of a jerk or any of those sorts of things? And, you know, at some point you have to lose the weight anyway, so you just have to find out. I feel so far all the changes have been really positive. You know, my Alex says that I walk around more lighthearted now. And that's, you know, that's not the only part that's lighter, but that's the important part. And so I see the world as less an obstacle course and more as something to be embraced in an adventure. And that's been a really big change for me, because I used to just see everything around me as a potential threat or something that I needed to worry about. And I feel that much less than I used to. And so far, all these things have been great changes. And I hope also have deeper relationships with my friends, because this my weight was the one thing I just didn't want to talk about. And now that I've put it out there in public for everybody to talk about, I hope that will lead me to be a better friend and for them to share more with me as well. So far, so good.
By the end of the book, you were down 85 pounds. We know books have long lead times. How are you doing?
Well, I had a roller coaster last year. Three people who were very dear to my wife and I, my best friend, who I've known since seventh grade, my father-in-law and my mom, all died like back to back to back. And it just tore a giant hole in our lives. And so I gained some weight back during that period. But the difference is that now I know I can do it. And once the worst of that grieving was over, I was able to get right back into my program. I'm back down to where I was basically at the end of the book and headed back in the right direction again. So that's another big change for me. Before, I would, something like that would just have thrown me into, you know, the abyss. And now it just feels like something I can climb my way out of. And that's a big difference in my life.
The name of the book is Elephant in the Room, One Fat Man's Quest to Get Smaller in a Growing America, a memoir by Tommy Thomas. And Tommy, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so much, Allison.